everybody. Welcome back to Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast. We are doing episode 242. And as you all know, we are a Paul McCartney talk show mainly dealing with the solo career of the legend himself, Paul McCartney. I'm one of your two co-hosts, Tom Hunyadi. You may know me from my other show, Talk More Talk, a solo Beatles video cast. And as always, I'm joined by my partner in crime, my backwards traveler. He is Andy Nichols. Andy, my friend, what you been up to?
Happy to be back and doing another fresh episode and a new series and having a returning guest and colleague of ours. And I'm really excited for this one tonight.
Yeah, as you can see, we have Alan Cozen here, who is the co-writer, along with Adrian Sinclair, of the wonderful, fantastic, arguably the most important book series in the history of McCartney as a solo solo recording artist, The McCartney Legacy. And we are starting a new series where we take a look at some of these iconic songs throughout McCartney's career. And we thought, who better than Mr. Cozen and Mr. Clare themselves? Now, unfortunately, Sinclair is not here with us at this time, but hopefully we will have him and or Cozen joining us at any given time. So, Alan Cozen, it's great to see you. Welcome back, my friend. How you been?
It's great to be back. I've been fine. You know, we finished volume two, and in the process of preparing for volume three by scanning all of my McCartney files and making them into searchable PDFs so that we can get to all the info we need. Mm-hmm. But that's apart from all of the research Adrian does, which is mountainous compared to what I have in my files. But we're also, you know, we're getting up to the point where I began covering him for the Times when I was at the Times. Yes. And so my files become quite, you know, a lot more dense from now on. So I'm looking forward to getting to that point.
Well, your book, the volume two is now up for pre-order, and it's had a success already. So it was already the number one book was, as they say, and pre-order sales. So that's gotta be pretty exciting.
It
is. Do you have a number, a solid number on those pre-sale numbers?
I haven't seen it. Adrian may know, but I really don't know. But I know that shortly after they announced it was open for pre-sale, Amazon had it listed as the number one new rock book, which, given that nobody has a copy and it hasn't even really been edited yet, that's actually not bad, you know.
Speaking of editing, when do Annie and I, when do we get our PDF sent?
When it's been edited.
Yeah, I know. I'm teasing. But no, seriously, I mean, I can't tell you how much of a joy it was to be able to read the first volume and just learn so many different things. And I know you guys didn't set out to bust myths and stuff like that, but I mean, it just happened that way because, as we know, the four, they're not the best historians within their careers and Beatle career, wouldn't you say?
Well, right. You know, they don't do what we do, which is sit around and listen to the stuff over and over and try and figure out how it was done, because they were there. They know how it was done and they move on to the next thing. So they're not historians. Plus, they're as fallible as the rest of us are in terms of memory, especially as they get older. So, things that Paul says today are not necessarily as accurate as, you know, what we try to do when we're researching is we try to find information as close to the event, you know, his comments as close to the event as possible on the theory that those will be the most accurate. It's not necessarily true. You know, sometimes people close to an event have an agenda and they might not want to say everything about something, or they may want to put it in a way that puts it in a light that isn't, you know, absolutely 100% accurate. And then maybe 10 years later when they're talking about it, it may become more accurate. So, you know, it's constantly weighing, you know, different quotes about the same thing and trying to figure out what's the most accurate. It's difficult. You know, we have debates about it all the time. So, you know, we're just sort of doing our best to get to the truth, and that's all you can do.
That's all you can do.
Dare we ask where you think Volume 3 starts and ends, or is it too soon?
It'll start in 1980, and the way we're thinking now, it probably will go to maybe just before the 89 tour kicks off, because if we get onto the tour, then we have to do the whole tour, and a tour, you know, while we cover them because they're in his life and they're what he does and all that, tours are not necessarily the most exciting reading, and they don't necessarily give you anything like a cliffhanger ending or anything like that. So we may start and we may end before the tour, or else we have to go all the way into 1990. So we'll see.
Yeah. And how many times, how many reviews can you read of the same set list that was great every night and go through
it? That reviews where the editors have called it, Paul has a new band on the run. You know?
Right.
Oh, you got that book for this pretty of much. Course.
Right. Right.
But you, the way you guys have structured it, I mean, Volume 1, right, starts at the low point and it ends at such a high. And then with Volume 2 coming up, we're still at this high, but then we're kind of, in a way, not spoiling anything. We're ending at a low. And in 1980, there's really actually kind of two lows, because then with Volume 3, you can almost start where Volume 1 started. It was kind of almost like at a low and then ending at a high in a way.
Right, right. You know, it depends how you define a low. I mean, Paul himself was apparently not happy with Back to the Egg. I personally love Back to the Egg, so I think he ended on a high. Although, you know, I say ending with Back to the Egg, but the fact is that he recorded McCartney 2 in the summer of 79 after Back to the Egg. Mm-hmm. And so that's in Volume 2 as well, even though the record hadn't come out yet.
Right.
So, yeah, but, you know, And he has a very successful little British tour at the end of 79. And then he's about to tour Japan, and I'll just leave it there.
There you go. There you go for Volume 2. In terms of a little kind of newsworthy items here before we dive into a topic at hand, nothing really pressing other than, do we know any more about Man on the Run, the documentary that we think maybe is coming out at the end of this year, right?
That is the last I heard, end of the year. But who knows? You know, productions often go into overtime, and it may not be out by the end of the year. But they haven't announced anything other than end of 24.
Right. And the only other thing really is that Paul has been dropping a couple of things. Well, we talked about it last week. And actually, Adrian and I messaged about it, these kind of BBC recording, bootleg recordings of the some of the Wings tours that were just being dropped for copyright dump reasons.
Yeah. They're not really BBC recordings. I mean, I don't think I don't think that show was ever broadcast on the BBC.
No, I didn't think it was.
But, you know, they had recorded that show professionally, and there is an acetate of it around that had been bootlegged. All the members of Wings were given it. All the members of Brinsley Schwartz, who were second bill to them on that tour, were given it. And so there are copies around, and it could have come from anywhere, because it has been out on bootleg. Whether that's a copyright thing, I mean, Adrian's theory, maybe he had thought of it differently when he spoke to you, but when we spoke about it, his feeling was that, you know, sometimes YouTube just puts things on people's pages that seem thematic, that isn't necessarily the person whose page it is putting it on. And so he thought that might be one reason that Sheffield concert was on. It wasn't even the best quality of that.
No, it was not. No,
there are better bootlegs out of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Newcastle
show is
was it Newcastle or Sheffield? Newcastle. It was Newcastle.
I mean, the CD from the Big Barn Bed Box, you know, mm-hmm. big barn, you know, that means sounded 10 times better than what we got
right
with this dump.
Right.
So it's kind of surprising in that sense. Speaking of the, you know, one last thing about the book, I know you guys know that MPL did receive, you know, volume one with the success of volume one and then going into volume two. I mean, any words with any more, any contributions from MPL now going forward, or are you guys just now still now just this is on your own and no help from them at all?
We're still on our own. We haven't approached them again. You know, we approached them at the beginning of volume
right.
one. We never approached them when we started volume two, because we figure, you know, they know we're here. If they liked volume one, maybe they'll volunteer to be
right.
involved, but they haven't. And but they also, again, are not stopping us. They're not doing anything to get in our
right.
way. When people go to Paul and say, can we talk? Do you mind if we talk to these guys? He's been mm-hmm. saying, yeah, sure, go ahead. Right. So, mm-hmm. you know, we're happy for that, because he could say, right. you know, I'd rather you didn't. And
right.
he hasn't. So, you know, I have to think that if he's read the book at all, you know, there are obviously some stories in there that maybe he would have preferred weren't, or
right.
you know, whatever. But I think he has to look at it and say, okay, they really are treating my work with respect, and you know, they're not trashing things. They're not offering even. We're not even offering our own opinion about
no.
things. We quote reviews,
right?
You know, and that is one thing that came up, like in the 910 review, the reviewer said, you know, I don't understand why Alan Kozin was a music critic for 40 years. Why is he not expressing an opinion? And the thing is that what we're trying to do is show the opinions of the time. So the fact that Ram is now considered one of his great albums is kind of irrelevant to us, because at the time it took a lot of criticism, and we're printing the criticism. We're also printing positive reviews if we find them. But what I think, where I think my own critical view comes out, is that if I describe a track like Backseat of My Car or Little Lamb mm-hmm. Dragonfly or some of the songs that I think are just incredible, I kind of think that it comes out in the description that I think it's incredible, because what I'm basically saying is, okay, this is what McCartney's doing. This is what's unusual about it. And this is why it works. You know, that's kind of music criticism in a way. It's maybe sneaky music criticism, but it's, but I can't help myself. It's what I do.
You guys have written the book like the, you know, as a, you know, proper historians. You've left yourself out of it, and you're letting the history tell the story.
Speak
right.
for itself, really.
Yeah. And that was largely Adrian's idea. I mean, left to my own devices, I would be, you know, doing opinions right and left, because it's, you know, like I say, what I do.
Right.
But, you know, the fact that in a way that the two of us are so different in so many ways, I mean, British and American, he's 43 years old, I'm 69.
Right.
You know, so I lived through it, and he grew up with it as the background of his growing up. You know, it already was there. He was, you know, taking it in. He didn't want criticism. I would have, you know, all these things that we sort of have negotiated, I think have made it a much stronger project and have made it a really great collaboration. I mean, we debate stuff all the time, but we don't fight, you know, we don't have personal fights. We, you know, we get along really well. I mean, I really admire Adrian, and I think it's mutual. But you know, we've just become really good friends doing this, and I'm really grateful for the collaboration. It's because collaboration's tough, and I've never collaborated on writing before. You know, I've always been a solo practitioner. So
and doing it internationally also.
So it's been good.
I've come to the conclusion after doing this show now for whatever 8 years or whatever, it's just like, I try to be positive and negative at the same time, you know, where I'll poo-poo on something, but I won't kick it, you know, while it's down. You know, it's like Off the Ground is not my favorite album, but I'm just not going to continue to just bash it and bash it when it could be somebody else's favorite album. You know, yeah. So like, I feel like, who am I to bash this album when I don't like it? But that doesn't mean it's not going to have its fans.
There's another thing that I've discovered, excuse me, in the process of doing this, is that in the past, when I've listened to Paul stuff, except for the stuff that I reviewed for the Times, so we're talking about starting like 89 or so, I basically, you know, put them on and listened to them, maybe listened to them a few times, maybe periodically pulled them out and listened to them. But right. I wasn't really doing really deep analytical listening. And for this project, we were doing deep analytical listening for every single track, all the outtakes we could find of the track, going through all the paperwork to try and see how the track was made. And it's given me a lot of respect for stuff that I, before writing the book, really didn't like much. I mean, I was not a fan of Wildlife. I'm not going to say that Wildlife is the greatest album ever made, but I have a lot more respect for Wildlife now that I have sort of walked through the process of putting it together. You know,
gotcha.
There are still some things that seem a little bit sleight of hand, you know, like Mumbo, you know, and Take It, Tony, and, you know, right. The Jam kind of sound. And it sort of gives the impression, and they basically would say in interviews that, like, this was live in the studio. But it kind of wasn't live. If you listen to all the parts being played, there were more parts being played than there were members of Wings. So it was not live in the studio, you know. Right. And as we went through the paperwork, we saw exactly what they did and what was added when and how, what was edited, you know. So and I actually have more respect for the real story than for the myth. You know, so, right. You know, we basically told what happened, but I ended up coming out of that liking Wildlife a lot more than I had when I went into it, especially side two, actually, you know, yeah. All the ballads. Those are actually some right. pretty nice songs, you know, but you get the impression overall, partly because of side one and the, you know, the intention of being sort of rocky and rough. You get the impression that it's a really sloppy album, but it's not really that sloppy, an album, especially side two. So,
right. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. So, you know, getting on with our main topic here, like I said, this is going to be a new series featuring the iconic tracks or songs, you know, throughout McCartney's career. So, you know, going in order, obviously, starting with the big one from the McCartney album, which, you know, maybe I'm amazed. I mean, if we're going to start, I guess we should start.
What start better place to start?
With the mother of them all. You know, but before we get in the track, I guess it's important to also kind of understand where he was coming from before the song was conceived or written or recorded. I mean, as we know, we've heard the story from Paul hundreds of times, where, you know, he got the news from John. He wanted to, you know, to break up the Beatles, but we didn't want to say anything. And, you know, he was told to keep his mouth shut. Paul and Linda, they go to their Hyde Park home, and they're there for months while Paul is dealing with his depression and Linda bringing him back up. The song out of that really is thankfully from Linda, right? I mean, if it wasn't for really Linda, you know, doing these things, helping Paul get out of this depression, we probably would never have this masterpiece of a song.
Yeah, absolutely. He was actually only there for a month or less. He got there October 22nd, and he was back in relatively early November because it started snowing and they had a baby and, you know, and a ramshackle house. And
yeah, with like no running water, so they weren't going to stay there.
Yeah, so they came back more quickly than we tend to think because of the way he tells the story.
Right.
When he came back, even before he left, he had arranged to borrow this four-track Studer deck from EMI and have it set up in his music room. And he was going to record something. It could have been an album. It could have been a bunch of demos. He wasn't totally sure what it was going to be. I mean, basically, he was hedging his bets. If he liked it, he was going to put it out. And if he wasn't crazy about it, it was going to go on the shelf of demos. And he started working on this. But what did he have in terms of new stuff originally? The Lovely Linda, and That Would Be Something. Well, The Lovely Linda is like half a verse of a song. And he even said in the self-interview press release that, you know, this is like a trailer for a movie. I'll finish it and do it again sometime. Right. He never did. That Would Be Something is it's also not much of a song. It's kind of a little blues riff and, you know, a light lyric. And those are the only two things he came back from Scotland with. So what is he doing for the rest of the album? He's doing some jams, which became things like Mama Miss America and Ooh You and other things. But otherwise, you know, he's looking backwards. He's getting Teddy Boy from the Beatle days.
Glasses.
He's going all the way back to Hottest Son, yep, which was like 1958. So, right. And Suicide, right, you know, the little bit of Suicide that we get, you know, was like one of his first songs. So he's sort of pillaging his unfinished back catalog. But then, you know, he had the chords for Maybe I'm Amazed. He didn't really have a lyric. He just had the idea for the song. And with about as much of the album as he could do at home already done, he and Linda went sort of, you know, driving around the South. Linda was looking for another property. She loved it up in Scotland. And they had this nice place on Cavendish Avenue in London, you know, basically walking distance from Abbey Road. But she wanted a place in the south of England that would be more of a, you know, more of like John's Tittenhurst Park, you know, just like a mansion on grounds, plenty of room for horses, all that stuff that, you know, we've seen the letters that she wrote to, well, they're quoted in the book. You've seen them too.
Right.
Real estate people. And they're looking. And so they went for a drive around the South, you know, partly just as a getaway and partly to look at, you know, at places that they would consider or cities, towns they'd consider, whatever. And while doing that, you know, he sort of finished up Maybe I'm Amazed and went into the studio.
Right.
He had already started doing things in the studio because I think he realized he was about at the end of what he could do at home. You know, he didn't have a mixer. He didn't have VU meters, you know. And I think he, after doing most of the album that way, he decided, you know, I want to do this more in the manner to which I'm accustomed.
Right.
And he...
Well, I mean, not to interrupt, sorry, but because there is no evidence of him doing any kind of demo whatsoever of Maybe I'm Amazed during those home sessions.
Nope. He just walked into the studio and I think it was it
February 15.
Yeah. And that was at EMI.
Under a pseudonym.
Just sat down and did it. And, you know, track by track, the whole thing in one day. And,
you know, you got upon the return to London, Paul was keen to get to his latest work on tape. And since he had already booked EMI Studios, he bypassed the home demo stage. Maybe I'm Amazed was recorded in a single session on the evening of February 15. I mean, that's kind of like, in a way, what was the Badfinger, If Come and Get It, in a way, right? Where he just records this in one evening.
He did that in an hour. In the morning before the session.
Yeah, he did that in an hour. Right, yeah. He did that in an hour.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
You know, but with an engineer and with, you know, a board and you know, all the equipment he wanted. There's a big difference between Maybe I'm Amazed and most of the other stuff on the McCartney album. Yes. You know, another exception is Karina Crore, which was another studio thing. And, you know, right. I mean, we're talking about Maybe I'm Amazed, so I won't go too much into Karina Crore. But, you know, with that one, I mean, he went out and bought a bow and arrow, and he set up a campfire, and he and Linda would, you know, made animal noises and sped up the tape to make them sound more animally. And, you know, and this was just the day after seeing a documentary.
Right.
About a Brazilian Indian tribe that was very sort of non-gregarious. And it was called The Tribe That Hides from Man. They weren't even friendly with the other tribes around.
Right. No. Yeah. I found a bit. You can find a bit of an expert from it on YouTube, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen the whole thing, actually. It's a really fascinating documentary. Yeah. And, right. You know, and it has music, you know, mostly Western music. You know, you can see this is the thing about Paul, and it's one of the things that has come through both volumes, is that he's kind of like an idea sponge. You know, he'll see something, it could be anything. And you never know what is going to trigger an idea for him that is going to become a song, you know? Right. So there was that one, and that one's a little bit out there. You know, I think a lot of people probably skip that track on the album, although it's got great stuff in it. Yeah.
No, I play that every time. That's one of my favorites. Yeah.
But, you know, but Maybe I'm Amazed is really, you know, to me and most people, I'm sure, is really the heart of that album, you know.
Correct. We'll get to that part, you know, a little later. But you got here, he played every single instrument, did all the vocals with one small contribution from Linda. But it was a song, Maybe I'm Amazed. He did the whole thing, start to finish, every instrument, bass, drum, guitars, taped in EMI's Studio 2, the large room where Beatles did most of the recordings. And then you talk about which, you know, the tracks, what track had which instrument on them, which one had the vocals, backing vocals. I mean, it was an 8-track, right? And you end up using all 8 tracks for this.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. So, you know. And, you know, and it's got 3 solos, which is unusual for him.
Right.
There's, you know, a really interesting chord progression, really interesting use of texture, like, you know, the organ at the very beginning. Right. You know, it's I don't know, that track is just genius.
And a fade in too, no less.
Yeah. There's just so much in it. It never gets old. It's, you know, it's one of those.
He had familiar company working with him. He had, you know, Phil McDonald, engineer, and Alan Parsons as the assistant to Phil. So, I mean, people he did, you know, kind of know working with him. This was like, and he said it was a hush-hush project. He did have a different name, right?
Billy Martin.
Billy Martin. And while we're talking side personnel, I just want to ask Alan a question, because I just am about finished with Ken Womack's book on Mal Evans. And I got up to this point right when kind of Mal had kind of really been working more with John and George and Ringo, and Paul had kind of done his own thing. Mm-hmm. And Mal and Paul were pretty tight there for a while,
right?
You know, in the heyday of the Beatles. And by this point, when he's recording McCartney, you know, he had gone to Scotland. All of a sudden, you know, Mal gets a call from Paul saying, "Can you bring this, you know, 4-track over to my house?" And that's according to Ken Womack. Did you guys, was it Mal the one who brought over the 4-track recorder to Cavendish that you know of?
I thought it was Eddie Klein and another guy, but you know, if Mal says that he did it, he very well might have, and they might have come over to set it up, you know.
Yeah.
because they were technical guys, they weren't necessarily there to drag equipment, but they were there to set it up for him so that it, you know, it was tested and worked by the time he got back from Scotland and wanted to start recording.
And how long did actually he record at home? You know, he's always recorded these at, like, before he actually went. I mean, he went in February. How long was he recording this at home, all this material?
Pretty much, you know, the second half of December, I think, really. And he might have done some things in January. I think the last thing he might have done is every night. And then he was running into problems with, you know, a buzz and all that. And I think he just maybe had enough. And, you know, I don't want to be the engineer too anymore. You know,
but that's the great thing. That's the great thing of your book is, you know, we assume that he and Linda and the kids are in at High Park for months, you know, because and then all of a sudden just the album pops up. Well, I mean, we don't really realize that he was, like you said, he was only there for maybe a month and comes back and then he's quietly doing these home demos. And then, you know, as we know, got, you know, goes back into EMI as a different name and slowly, you know, starts to record these tracks professionally.
Right. Right. Yeah. Only a few of the tracks. The ones he recorded at home pretty much are as he recorded them on the album. I don't even know that he did too much in the way of overdubbing onto those. There might have been one or two he added something to, but mostly that's how they were. And the new stuff at EMI was just new stuff at EMI that was added to the batch. And so in a way you listen to the album and there's kind of a disparity between That Would Be Something and, you know, Maybe I'm Amazed, but I always thought it all hung together. I mean, because the story that had always come out, I mean, it's really only a bit later that we began to realize what was done at EMI and what was done at home and all of that. The impression that you got originally when it came out was that this is an album he recorded on his own at home. And okay, so you have a certain expectation for a recorded at home album, you know, different than a recorded at Abbey Road album. So, you know, you just sort of accepted it as kind of homespun, although a lot of the reviews thought it was too homespun, you know, and that was, you know, he always reacted to reviews in a way, you know, this was too homespun. So, okay, with Ram, we're going to be really careful. We're going to get an orchestra in, we're going to, you know, record it in a studio. It's going to be with studio musicians. And then what happens? He's criticized for being too slick.
Yeah. I think the public at large and critics at the time just couldn't wrap their heads around the fact that a guy detached himself from, you know, a bad situation and locked it down with his family just to figure himself out for a little while. You know, it wasn't going to be some grandiose Abbey Road Side 2 thing or even Let It Be. You know, I mean, even though Maybe I'm Amazed, I think is as good as Let It Be. I think that's the problem with the fans and the critics. They were expecting that caliber of stuff. And he just came out with a nice, organic, quiet, rustic album. And people were like, well, what is this? You know?
Right. Yeah. But I mean, I liked this one when it came out. It was because everyone was sort of curious. Okay, what's Paul going to do? You know, what's his first album going to be? It's, you know.
Right.
And I thought it was okay, you know, and not just because Maybe I'm Amazed, although that obviously was the center of gravity, but I kind of liked it all. And I think it's difficult for us to understand how you can go from being a Beatle to having the crisis of confidence that he had, you know, and in a certain way, it was difficult for Linda too. And it's a good thing because Linda told him all the stuff that any of us would have told him. Wait a minute. You know, you're one of the world's great songwriters. You're one of the world's great bassists. You're one of the world's great vocalists. What are you upset about? You know, you know, and you've done recordings on your own. You know, you did the Bad Finger thing, you Come and Get It. There were certain Beatles tracks that are, you know, all or mostly you. What's the big deal? So you just go on. But for him, you know, it's hard for us, I think, to realize that for him, the loss of the group, you know, Mark Lucid and I always have to, you know, have had this argument, and I think it applies more to the early Beatles than the late Beatles. But when I wrote Alan Williams's Obit in the Times, I got a call from Mark saying, you know, you say they're a band, but they were a group. So, well, okay, Mark, you know, that is a word that we use interchangeably here. But I think what Mark really meant was that it was a group, as in it was a gang. You know, the Beatles were his gang, and they had been his gang from a very early age and for his entire adult life. So it wasn't just that, okay, your group's gone, but you're a great musician, you just carry on. It's like your whole social cloud has evaporated. You know, everybody who was your closest friends in the world are now sort of arrayed against you because you don't want Alan Klein to be your manager, you know? And that has to have been really hard for him, you know?
That's a great kind of breakdown between the two words, you know, band and group, because a band is great. It's just musicians, right? But as you point out, it's more than just being in a band. It was everything. It was his, as you said, it was his social life. It was his everything. So it wasn't just a band ending. It was a way of life, too.
Yeah. And if you consider as well, you know, there's a quote I included in the book from John Kurlander, who was one of the engineers they worked with. John went on to be a classical producer for EMI, and classical music is mostly what I covered at the time. So I went to a session he did in Philadelphia with the Philadelphia Orchestra, and then we went to lunch, and I started talking to him about the Beatles. And he said, here's the thing about the Beatles. Individually, they were all the greatest guys. You would have an incredible time with any of them. Two of them together, it was still Three of them, it got a little bit dicey. If you were in the room with all four of them, they were the most horrible people in the world, and it didn't matter what your relationship with each of them was, you were not them. So there was this very definite, you know, them versus everybody else that probably was forged during the Beatlemania period when they were stuck in the back of a truck or, you know, locked in a hotel room and, you know, unable to do very much. You know, there was the fact that there was the world out there and there was the four of them. So, you know, factor that into the personality aspect as well and how the split of the Beatles has to have affected Paul.
Right, so, right.
Yeah, right, which makes this journey of a track, to bring it full circle back to Maybe I'm Amazed, pretty remarkable, because it's still very in the early throes of the breakup and everything. And he's found, you know, finally, you know, like a light that he can kind of, you know, see on. Okay, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. I can get through this. And here's this. I'm going to write this amazing song.
Well,
you know.
So let's break that down then onto tracks here, because then, on, you know, on one track we got Paul Begins with piano and lead vocals, so on that's just one track. Let's talk about the piano. I mean, this is like the piano ballad from Paul. I mean, people are going to remember this as one of his greatest vocal performances and maybe one of his best tracks for his piano playing as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's not flashy piano playing. It's it's, you know, it does what it needs to do to accompany the vocal without stealing attention from it. But it's, you know, it's very solid. It's Paul has, you know, in purely musical terms, he has an incredible amount of taste, and he knows when to play that kind of straightforward piano line that, you know, has a very full, warm sound. As you say, it almost is as important as the vocal in terms of the texture of the song. You know, and there are so many different things that you can do. He seems to always come up with the right way to do it. And certainly, and Maybe I'm Amazed, I mean, you can't argue with what he did.
Right. So that was track one and two. Track three, then he brings in the drums, which again, you know, as someone who loved playing drums as well, I think does a fantastic job with drums on this, and then bass on track four. You got backing vocals on track five, and then you know track six. I think then track four was bass. So again, you know, bass he which is his signature instrument, kind of plays a second fiddle in a way to, I think, one or third fiddle, even if you include the piano and his guitar solos that he right. performs on this track, mm-hmm. in a way. So in a way, I mean, he's also showing off his guitar playing skills, which I think, I know we get, sometimes we get into a debate whether or not the live version with Jimmy playing guitar is better than the studio version with
Paul. Well, I'll touch on that in a minute, solo. But I want to let Alan yeah. answer, but I want to ask him a question about the evolution, but continue, Tom.
Go ahead. But I'm saying, I mean, it that bass kind of almost is secondary to all these other instruments.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, it's not one of his fancier bass lines.
Right.
So, and, yeah. Are there any more tracks that you have to you have to go through?
Well, I mean, no. I mean, because then the rest are just backing vocals.
All right. So you have it on the arrangement, okay? Now we're talking about the studio, but Maybe I'm Amazed has a great kind of evolution in terms of being played live from its original gestation, you know, obviously the studio recording, and then you hear those early Wings versions of it. It's very different than what ends up being out on Wings Over America. So he was trying to polish it up a little bit, make it more of a big stage number that it became, obviously, iconically, when it was released as a single in 77. Just curious about your thoughts, Alan. You know, obviously he worked it into early Wings set list, but, you know, and I'm not every set list. Was it played on the university tour?
I don't think so, no.
No. So I think maybe, the first European tour is where it makes its appearance, I guess.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I think on the university tour, he didn't have a piano, didn't have any piano stuff, did he? I don't think so.
No, I think the song, for a lot of times, he just goes into the song. There's no big kind of piano intro to it kind of just goes right into it, and there's no big grand finale kind of fading out, kind of like the record. So I was just curious, it would be interesting to see where Paul decided to say, I'm going to make this song a little bit more flashy for live performances than it is on the studio record, which listen, it has its fans. Tom is on the record many times for saying how he prefers the studio version over the live. How do you feel, Alan?
I think I prefer the studio version too. But I don't dislike the live one.
Right.
I like the studio version because it's all him, because it's almost, to a degree, almost being composed there. I mean, he went in with the song and it's a finished song. But for instance, those guitar solos, I don't think he had premeditated necessarily. I think those were on the spur of the moment in the session. There's just, something about the fact that it's such an incredible track and it's all him is just very impressive to me. The live one, brilliant as it is a band where Paul has said, okay, Jimmy, this is what you play, you know, and Jimmy was somewhat better about that than Henry had been.
Right.
But Jimmy had his moments too. Rebellion.
Well, even when we had Lauren LJ on, we talked about that exact same thing, and he said, well, yeah, I mean, the structure of those solos are the same, but he was also able to fit in a couple different little, you know, chords here and sure. there, so it didn't have to be exact science all the time.
Right. Yeah, I guess Paul allowed a little bit of leeway, but generally speaking, the shape of the solo was what he wanted it to be. It's sort of interesting because Paul approaches it, these things, almost more like a classical composer than like a rock composer. I mean, you know, if you're Felix Pappalardi and you're writing for Mountain, you know, Leslie West is going to play whatever the hell he wants to play, you know, but you're writing it for Wings and you're Paul, and it's, okay, this is my idea of the solo and this is what I want you to play. And that was where he and Henry came to grief so many times. And finally Henry left over that.
Right.
But, you know, in the one time that he allowed Henry to do what he wanted to do was My Love. And that was a brilliant solo. So even sure. And even Paul admitted, and when the reviews came out, you know, almost every single review focused on the solo is being great. So you know, in a way, you sort of wish that he could have let a little more loose. But on the other hand, you know, you listen to something like Maybe I'm Amazed, and you know that, like, this is a guy who knows what he wants for that composition. So
absolutely, I agree. Let's switch to the lyrics, because I'm fascinated when you think of this. Is here's somebody that didn't do a demo for this track, just goes in
that we know
and
of,
does it. That we know of, right? And just, you know, this track just appears in one session. It's fascinating to me. I mean, obviously he's probably got the lyrics written down on a sheet. He's going over them while he does the song. But lyrically, I mean, it's not that much. But you feel the sense of the power that he has with his relationship with Linda in the lyrics. Especially, I love the, you know, baby, I'm a man, maybe I'm a lonely man who's in the middle of something that he doesn't really understand, that bit too for me. And then the way he sings that just really is one of the standouts lyrically for the track. I mean, how do you feel about it lyrically?
Yeah, I think it's one of his strongest lyrics, certainly for his early stuff. And for really a lot of his catalog, because, you know, with Paul, sometimes he has said he doesn't really care as much about lyrics as music. And so you have songs that have lyrics like bip, bop, bam, you know, or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, let's go for a drive. You know, I've always been sort of against his counting songs. I don't think counting counts as a lyric. You know, you can do it once, and he already did it with All Together Now.
It's a rare song for him to talk about himself so personally, because he's so
absolutely
like taking a page out of Lennon. Like, you know, whereas Paul's very comfortable writing about paperback writers and you know,
but things like that. You got an interesting point like that. We'll mention that because he does kind of talk about that in the lyrics book as well, to where he, in a way, he'll write it in a way where it doesn't necessarily mean him. It can mean anybody, really.
It could, but obviously he's pretty raw emotionally here right now, and it's all over the song and the lyrics, to your point here.
You know, so And I Love Her can be about Jane, or it could not be about Jane, you know. But Maybe I'm Amazed, given the history, given the circumstances, you know, you got to think that even if he were to deny that it was about Linda, which he hasn't done, you would still think, okay, you know, she did sort of hang him on a line, and she did, you know, pull him out of time. He was a lonely man in the middle of something that he didn't really understand. Now, in the context of this song, let's say a love song, where you're not necessarily thinking about it being Paul or the personality of the writer, you see a line like, maybe I'm a lonely man who's in the middle of something that he doesn't really understand. You could just take that as, you know, falling in love is just such a, you know, mysterious thing and all that. But I think that we know that he's also talking about his situation with regard to the Beatles, with regard to his, you know, starting his nascent solo career, and everything. He's in the middle of something that he doesn't really understand, and he's still picking his way through it. And so he's being really very honest here, but he's doing it in the context of a love song where it could mean a number of different things.
Right. Yeah, in the lyrics book also, he says, though the song written immediately after the Beatles breakup, it was somehow included under the Lennon-McCartney rubric, where it doesn't belong. It was one of my first songs. It's funny how he feels that way. I don't understand why he would feel that way.
Is that ever credited Lennon-McCartney? I don't think so.
No. I've never seen it credited as Lennon-McCartney.
Well, this is why I say that memories are as fallible for former Beatles as it is for us.
Right.
Maybe he's confusing that with Give Peace a Chance, which is.
Right.
Yes, that's right.
Yes, That's true. That's true. Then he goes on here. While it's true that Linda is the person I'm addressing, it is also true that I'm dealing in fiction. Starting with myself, the characters who appear in my songs are imagined. I can't state that often enough. I know that in some quarters, it's felt you can't write about gay people unless you're gay, or about Asian Americans unless you're Asian Americans. Mm-hmm. I think that's silly. That's like saying that because James Joyce wasn't Jewish, he shouldn't have written about Leopold Bloom. So, you know, he doesn't really, I mean, he gets into just little bits, of the song. He doesn't really, talk a lot about, putting the song together and a lot of these lyric, the songs right. that he, how much did you get from this? After, because your book was supposed to come out. I mean, you actually postponed the book because of the lyrics book. Yeah. What were your thoughts on the lyrics book? Were you able to take anything away from it?
There may be a couple of comments that we quote, but generally speaking, I'm not sure how to diplomatically put this. I mean, I'm happy to have the lyrics book. I'm happy to have anything he writes or dictates or is interviewed for or whatever. And puts out.
Right.
But I can't say I got an awful lot about it from it because, the songs that we covered that are in the lyrics book, we had researched really thoroughly. And so I don't believe there were any cases where we looked in the lyrics book and said, wow, we totally missed it. What we did do is we'd say, well, okay, he's saying in the lyrics book that he took the name for Jet from a horse, and he horse, shows the picture right. of the horse, but that horse was born after he wrote Jet, and we have interviews from the time where he talks about Jet being a puppy and how it was the runt of the litter and they gave them all away. And we even know the other names of the puppies in the litter. One was called Basker Menon, or what was it? The U.S. head. It was someone I
had. Alan, knew. Not Alan Livingston.
No. Brown Megs.
Oh.
Yeah. So, we tend to believe that it really was really about the puppy. And now, whether he got the name from a puppy or a horse is not a huge important matter, but, we're reading this book as a source of information and we're saying, okay, but that's not right. And also I believe he repeated the story of George Martin taking Live and Let Die to
right, yeah,
the producers,
right,
yeah. And he knew better than that. Right. And that was George Martin's story that he adopted. And so things like that I found kind of disappointing, but on the other hand, not, because he's not a historian and he doesn't have to get it right. It's his life. He can say what he wants,
Yeah.
He could say, if he wanted, he could say, okay, you may think this is about Linda, but I had already met Nancy. totally ahistorical, but if that's what he wanted to say, he could say it. And, right. Who's going to argue except, well, we will. But, right. I see how he says and wants to say that, you have to understand that all the people in these songs are imagined people. I think in the right. case of Maybe I'm Amazed, there's a certain degree to which Paul, the professional songwriter writing a love song, has in mind that it should be a song that anybody could sing about the person they love. And in that sense, it has to be an imagined person because, it can't be that personal about Linda. But, look at the lyrics, look at the circumstances, right. look at the situation. I think you kind of have to see that this is a very personal song for him. And the fact that given everything else on the album, that he gave such a super performance of this song.
Yes.
And had Linda do some backing vocals on it, You know, I think he knew what Linda had done for him, you know, to get him to the point where he could record a song like Maybe I'm Amazed when he was in such bad shape. Mm-hmm. And I think there really is a sense of gratitude that comes through the song. You know, it doesn't sit here and say, I'm so grateful for you, but it does say, you know, you're the only woman who could ever help me, you know. You know, and I'm amazed at the way I really need you. Because let's face it, you know, Paul had been through a lot of women, and none of them had really made him feel he needed them necessarily.
Right.
You know, Linda was a big difference, you know. And as Linda says, you know, they had their fights like everybody else. You know, and she definitely found the situation up in Scotland a bit frustrating. You know, we have a quote in the book, I think, where she even says, you know, look, I'm a mother with a young baby and, you know, and Heather was older, but she was still a little kid. And she's in this house and she's got, and I've got a husband who doesn't want to get out of bed and just wants a drink. And, you know, some of her frustration comes out in quotes like that, you know? And so in a way, Linda is also fighting for her life here, you know?
Right.
Just married this guy like 9 months earlier.
You know, settling down, coming over from England, you know, America, whole new lifestyle.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and she also, in a way, you know, like I said, you know, if all of us look at the Beatles and we, you know, you break up and, you know, and you're Paul McCartney, well, you know, why is it a problem? Linda came to it with some of the same views that we would have had. You know, there's another quote in the book where Paul is complaining about the horrible situation. And she said, well, what are you complaining about? You guys are the princes of the world, you know? And it was only after sort of being there for a while that she realized that being princes of the world meant that, like, everybody who could suck something out of them did or tried, you know?
Yeah.
And that, you know, that was why they were the four, you know, impenetrable, you know, quartet, that if you were someone who wasn't one of them, you found them horrible to be with. Maybe George Martin didn't, you know, but
or Brian.
Or Brian.
Right.
But, you know, even Brian, you know, they could be, you know, Brian could come into the studio and you know, make some suggestion and have John say to him, well, you know, Brian, why don't you see to the accounts, you know?
Right.
Epi, good old Epi. Let's move on. Not released as a single, even though a promotional video was made for this to help promote the album, I guess. Rather than the song as a single. Let's talk about not being a single, potential as a single. Do you think this would have done well as a single?
Was it ever even considered, Alan?
No, because he didn't think that you took singles off albums at that point. You know, even as late as Band on the Run, he had to be argued with, you know, first to put Hell in Wheels on the US version.
Right.
And then to take Band on the Run and Jet and, you know, off as singles. You know, Al Corey from Capitol had to, you know, sit him down and say, listen, you know, when we did it with Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, which was a good choice because Paul loved Dark Side of the Moon and
sure
he loved
did.
Pink Floyd. When we took it off Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, it immediately sold another few hundred thousand and went up the charts again, you know, and Band on the Run went to number one three times because of the singles taken off it. So it took some time for Paul to think of having singles off albums as something you do.
They had no problem doing that in America with Uncle Albert off Ram.
Right. Right. Yeah, I guess he looked at, you know, America slightly differently, you know, more and commercial. He put out Backseat of My Car in England as well. Mm. It wasn't something he liked doing. And I guess with Maybe I'm Amazed, I think it would have been great if he had, because it would have, I really think, been a big hit, and it would have driven the sales of the album
Yeah,
a lot more.
Right. And it would have given him probably the real shot in the arm that he needed, given the early success of Harrison, Ringo, and Lennon, and all the critical praise that they got on their albums.
Yeah, right. But we all know that he dealt with confidence issues, you know, especially throughout the 70s. You know, asking, you know, execs whether or not he should release this as a single or this as a single.
I'm just saying, but if that had come out as a single and pushed and promoted and done and taken off, maybe, you know, maybe he's not looked at so critically harshly with Ram and McCartney and Wildlife if that single comes out.
Right, right. You know, the thing about confidence issues, though, is that you sort of have to also understand that as difficult as it may be to understand why someone like Paul McCartney should have confidence issues, I think the fact that he has confidence issues is what drives him to do his best stuff. You know, if you just walk into the studio and you say, well, I'm Paul McCartney and I am the greatest thing since sliced bread, and now we will hit record, you know, who knows what you'll do? You know, you need confidence issues. Like it's one of the sorry aspects of the human condition. You know, you need to think that you're not great in order to be great. You know, it's ironic, isn't it?
And that's one of the things, because I know I tease you guys about the one of the authors that you've quoted in the book, the person that we do dare not mention on the show.
Oh, I think I know who you mean.
Yeah, you might know, but he also has these CDs out too.
Don't show them.
I'm not showing it, but it's funny listening to that, because he's got the Doodah Band on there, and he talked about how he comes in as a producer, and then he just comes up to the grand piano and just starts playing them Hey Jude and say, hey, what do you think, guys? and it's pretty funny how they just talk about this guy who just, you know, whimsically, you know, comes on in and then just produces this album, and they all do what he says, you know, because they think they're just all in all. And I think he feels that sometimes. When he's in a room like that, and he can read a room, absolutely. So it's pretty amazing when you think like that stuff. Well, how a guy like this does have confidence issues when he's written some of the most important songs. And
hey, man, Thingamabob. Yeah. It's all about Thingamabob. But that should have been on the album too.
Yeah. So, being on the album, I sometimes tease. I mean, I love Kareem Akure, but I don't know if it should like end the album. And if it does end the album, I think it should have been a hidden track where it's not listed. You know what I mean? Something kind of like how Her Majesty originally was. You know, because I mean, listen, Maybe I Maze is such a powerful track. I just always feel like that's the last song.
The last kinda like song. In a way, yeah.
Beautiful, because Flaming Pie, it's like Beautiful Night should be the last damn song, and then you got this little.
No, but then he likes to close out with a little, you know, kind of send you off kind of song.
Yeah,
I understand that.
Yeah, I think I talk in the book a little bit about that, about the sequencing of the album and how sort of strange it was to end with Kareem Akure,
and
that maybe I'm amazed, you know, really probably should have been the final track, but you know. Yeah, you know, another aspect of the insecurity thing is that because he's insecure about stuff, he sometimes relies a little more than he should on other people's opinions, and they're not always the most qualified people. I mean, I did an interview with him in 1990, and one of the nervier questions I asked him is, you know, why is it that, you know, Flying to My Home was just a B-side? Right. And, you know, why wasn't that on the album instead of something like Oué le Soleil, which, you know, I really didn't like that much. You know, it's just a
only
rhythm,
on the CD, though, Alan, and tape. It wasn't on the vinyl.
And he said, well, here's the thing. I write them. So I like them all, and it's really hard for me to tell which ones, you know, which ones are the best, which one should be on the album. So I play them to my friends' kids, and I figure out which ones they like the most. And I'm thinking, oh man, you know, I don't know. I don't know that I trust your friend's kids to your kid friends.
Right.
Right.
To determine what should be
right the running order, on the track listing.
But with this album, I don't think I don't know that he had that much outside input, because we talk about the sequencing of the album with, I think, Robin Black, and didn't really get the impression that he was necessarily open to advice. He decided the way it would be, and that was it. So why Karina Karoria's last, I don't know. Maybe Heather liked it. Heather's friends.
They saw that documentary and were like, oh, we've got to write this and tack it on.
Yeah.
Well, anyways, as we close this out, and we're in the, McCartney legacy, if you will, do you place this track? That's just like right out of the gate, we get an instant classic of McCartney track. I consider it one of his greatest compositions. Obviously, Rob Sheffield in that 100 countdown, he put it as his number one. I mean, did you feel, did you see that list, and how did you feel about that being number one? And then, what were your thoughts on where this track is in the McCartney canon?
Yeah, that is a harder question than you would think, just because the McCartney canon is so huge. On this album, this is far and away the best track, but Every Night is pretty good too, and there are some others. But, not too long after this, he did Backseat of My Car, which I think is an absolute masterpiece. And
same.
Little Lamb Dragonfly, which I also think is a masterpiece. And he didn't think enough of to finish for Ram. He sort of left it as a leftover for Red Rose Speedway, and then had, Denny Sywell, I think, said he helped finish it. But it's brilliant. It's great. It's great. There are so many incredible songs of his. It would be hard for me to say that this is number one, because I kind of think I like Backseat of My Car better. And My Brave Face, you go later in the catalog too, there's so many incredible things. But, let me put it this way. If I were to have put together pure McCartney, he basically needs a 4-disc greatest hits set. Maybe I'm Amazed would absolutely be on it, and it might be the opening track, chronologically, just because it is such a strong track. Let's say I might say it's within his top 10, maybe.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
I can go for that. Absolutely.
Easily top 10. Mm-hmm. But as Alan says, it's so big. It's such a big discography in canon. And sometimes we take a song like Maybe I'm Amazed for granted a little bit. Yeah, it's a classic, and we just forget about it. We forget about how important it was at the time when we kind of go back and look at it. I think it's a classic.
Right.
But it remains, it should be ranked as highly as it should, because it's that important of a track. In his personal life, his everything, and then just being a great song, musically.
And the fact that it also hasn't been overplayed. I mean, you hear
good
it a
point.
Lot, but,
yeah.
but, when Maybe I'm Amazed comes on, you don't have the same, not again, that you get when you hear Layla or Maggie May, the Rod Stewart's Maggie.
Yeah, I hear you. Yep.
Those are songs that I loved when they came out, and I still love them. It's just that they were overplayed and in a way overstayed their welcome. But Maybe I'm Amazed that never happened.
Studio with the one, Alan, but Alan, I think as a former New Yorker, we'll agree with this and know what I'm about to say. In New York, we have a station called 106.7 Light FM. And it's like kind of, kind of, you know, singer songwriter light stuff, and they used to play the hell out of the live version of Mamie, I'm Amazed.
Mm.
I don't know if you remember. I don't know if you, but I mean that station had the live version in its rotation for years.
Yeah, that might have been after my time of listening to the radio a lot.
Okay.
You know, at a certain point, I had so many records and so many new records coming in that needed my attention that I stopped listening to. I mean, I remember when I started writing, I had the radio on all the time. I had WNEW FM on all the time. And sometimes PLJ, and I don't think 106.7 was there yet. But, you know, eventually it's like, okay, you know, I've got records to review. I've got records to hear. I've got pieces to learn. I've got all this stuff. And so I sort of switched over to record listening.
And not the radio.
Yeah, you know, so.
But to your point, other than the live version, I mean, which I heard quite a lot of on the radio, but the studio version, as we're talking about, that does not, to Alan's point, you don't hear that and go, oh, it's Layla again, or, you know.
Yeah, Dream On, Hotel California.
No, it doesn't right. have that quality.
Don't Stop Believing, you know, it's and on and on and on. But,
right. So, you know, yeah. Paul might have in the back of his mind the complaint that, you know, maybe it isn't played enough. But in a way, that has helped it remain a beloved classic.
Yeah. And then, you know, obviously keeping it alive in his live concerts and, you know, its legacy has continued. It sat dormant for a while, but he brought it back out again in the last couple of years. And
right. It's now a little bit out of his vocal range, I think. You know,
I would agree.
Starting with like that Saturday Night Live performance.
Yes. Oh boy. You know, oh boy.
Because that's another thing that we didn't mention. It's actually a stunning vocal performance that requires a really supple voice and range. And he had it at the time and for decades after. It's only the last 10, 15 years that it's been a little beyond him. And, you know, maybe he could change the key. He could take it down.
He will never do that.
He'll never do that. I know, but
he was 28 years old when he recorded this. 28. Wasn't even 30.
Right. Right.
But he lived a lifetime already in a way.
Certainly. Yes.
You know, well, Alan, Alan, thank you for going down this road with the first installment of this iconic song series. We all know that, or hopefully everybody knows that you're also part of Things We Said Today podcast with our friends Ken Michaels and Darren DeVivo. Talk a little bit about that. You guys just dropped an episode for this week, and you guys have made the switch to doing every other week now, like twice a month now.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, because Ken has a podcast with you as well. So, you know, and we try to alternate. So 1 week he's doing yours, 1 week he's doing ours.
Right.
You know? And also, you know, I don't know about how you guys find it, but it gets really hard to think of a fresh topic every week. You know, every 2 weeks at least gives us some time to think and to listen or to read books or whatever we need to do.
But it should be easier for you guys because you guys are dealing with five camps where we're just mainly dealing with
one.
Right.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. It's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, what's the latest episode that you guys dropped?
Well, you know, because I took some time off to finish volume two, we are still catching up with certain things that we probably, you know, would have covered if I hadn't taken time off. So this one was the Red and the Blue albums and the underdubbed mixes of Band on the Run. And I also threw in the new HMC bootleg with because I've heard the stuff on it. I heard it while writing volume one, actually. And I don't think that disc is out there yet, but you know, just since your listeners are going to be obviously McCartney fans and will be interested in this, what the bulk or the main section of that disc is are the mixes that Jeff Emmerich made just before leaving Lagos. So songs that were not recorded in Lagos are obviously not there. Like
not there, right.
Blackbird, 1985. And the ones that are there are in a very unfinished state, you know, far more unfinished than the underdubbed mixes.
Wow.
You know, so yeah. And Picasso, I mean, there's the, some really interesting stuff in there that is, was sort of not mixed out or dubbed over or whatever, you know, they don't strike you quite as much on the finished version. But for instance, we know that Picasso was the last thing he recorded in Lagos, and he recorded it at Ginger Baker's Arc Studio. And the day before that, Fela Kuti had come to EMI Studio to accuse him of being an Africa to steal the black man's music. And Paul's, oh no, we absolutely are not. And, you know, he played him some tapes, and really for all the tapes he had done up to that point, there is nothing that you could say really is influenced by African music. And Ginger Baker came down, calmed Fela Kuti down, and then Paul went and recorded in Ginger's studio the next day, you know, partly as a thank you, I think, for doing that. But what do we hear in the very raw tapes of Picasso's last word, the closing section where they're going, ho, hey, ho.
Hey, ho.
Paul is also doing this, you know, waka, waka, you know, just like this African kind of singing, you know, and it's sort of like, you know, it's so typical Paul. You don't tell me what I can't do.
Yes.
Because now I'm going to do it.
Now I'm going to do it anyway.
So, in a way, fellow was a day late. Or, I mean, a day early, I should say.
That's right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, he could have beat Paul Simon to it, you know?
Yeah.
yeah. Oh.
But, you know, and you hear that. I think you hear that on the underdub mixes, too. But it's even clearer on what's going to come out on the HMC mix. And Band on the Run is kind of a mess on the HMC one. You know, there's a lot of stuff that is not finished. There's a couple of bars that are, you know, have repeated lyrics that he obviously sort of edited out because that was a mistake. But, you know, so if I were Paul, I wouldn't have put that out. I would have put out the underdub mixes as he did if I wanted to do something to show the process of Band on the Run. But for someone like, you know, me or Adrian or you guys or, you know, anyone really fascinated with how his music comes together, this bootleg is a killer. And
well, that and then the underdub would have made that box set in 2010 so much more worth it.
Yeah,
you know, so much more and so much more interesting. Even if we never get those supposed, you know, those demos that Cywill talks about, those two alone, you know, would have been easy score, or I mean, you know, 10 times better than what we did eventually get.
Sure. I do want those demos, though. I mean, that I really wish he would put those out. I want to see whether Denny Cywill is right saying that it's better than the finished
drums. And his drumming. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. So as we can expect, Volume 2, as of right now, we're expecting it to be released in December.
December 10th.
McCartney Legacy, December 10th. So please, if you want the series to continue, which hopefully we all do, please help support. Purchase the book, whether in physical format or Kindle, whatever way you can to help support and get what I think, like I said, this is the most important series in the McCartney solo career. As we know, as we talked about, you know, when you see the bios in the past, it's this thick of Beatles and this thick of solo. You know, this is what we all deserve and all we have wanted for all these years, and we're finally getting it. So And the work that Adrian and Alan have been putting into this series is legendary, and it should be talked about. You should just write a book on all the research that you guys have put into it.
Yeah, that would be a fascinating read too. The story of the McCartney legacy.
So Alan, we really appreciate you coming on and talking.
Thanks for having me.
You know, hopefully next month we'll have Adrian to join us as well. Andy, what do you got going on for your other channel?
Just that latest review that I did at, you know, with a buddy of mine over at NJIT radio station on Yes, which we kind of chewed the fat on some progressive rock for about an hour and a half. And that's been on my channel for about a week or so now. And that's the latest I've got on mine. But that's it.
All right. And Talk More Talk. We'll be back as this is a Saturday as it's posting. I think we're back on Monday. And I think we're going to talk about the Rob Sheffield 100 solo Beatles countdown, which again is, as we all know, it's just his opinion, so we're all of our lists would be totally different. Again,
real quick, Alan, did you think Imagine would be number one when you first saw the list coming out, or no?
I don't even remember what was number one. I mean, I skimmed it. I looked it over and I read bits of it. Yeah. And, you know, I like Rob. I mean, Rob is a very, very good Beatles journalist, I think. And, you know, his opinions are not necessarily mine, but he makes a case for his opinions. And I like that. So I'll be listening to your podcast about that.
Cool.
Gotcha. Yeah. So again, please check out our YouTube channel, Two Legs a Paul McCartney Podcast, and please subscribe there. If you have any ideas for a show, or if you want to say, hey, look, and if you're going to continue this iconic song series, maybe you should talk about this particular track, email us at twolegspodcast@gmail.com. When we get done here, maybe we're going to talk a second about which song to do next. And you know, it's great having you guys here. Thank you for listening. So as always, for Tom, Andy, Alan Kozin, have a great day and a beautiful night. Take care, everyone.
See you.
Listening to Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast, hosted by Tom Hunyadi and Andy Nichols, with musical contributions by Dylan.